You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is September 6th, 2023, and I am your host, Matthew Raphael Johnson. I mentioned last week that I was torn between two topics, and I'm going to do the other one this week, and that's the significance of the BRICS summit last month and its impact on the dollar and hence the ideology of liberalism, because they're closely related. And I'm using three articles published at the end of last month and using these as, you know, to deal with the question in some detail. Initially, I supported the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and continue to do so. That had a far harder core of Russia and China. BRICS is a bit looser as an organization, but it gets more media attention, and hence it must be more real than the SCO. But whatever BRICS does comes from the foundation that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization laid down. For those of you who've even, you know, read a headline about the BRICS summit, the 15th in the organization's history, this is extremely significant because the new members that were brought on, that won't be made official until January 1st, 2024, the new members are Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Iran, and the United Arab Emirates. This is a huge development. And it isn't just that Saudi Arabia is the world's top exporter of oil and the seat of Islam, really, but a long-standing ally of the U.S. and hence the regime. The Islamic world has pretty consistently leaned to Moscow and to a lesser extent China for a whole bunch of reasons. But for Saudi Arabia and Egypt, Egypt had its government overthrown by the regime several years ago. And if it can't count on these countries, then the regime is in serious trouble. The most populous Arabic country is Egypt. And these are extremely powerful countries with longstanding American financing. But to bring Islam in makes some sense politically. And UAE also, a huge loss for the United States. Now, we've spoken of Saudi Arabia and the tilt towards Russia and China on this show a few months ago. And that development is extremely important. And, of course, we have to deal with Iran. These are first world countries, with the possible exception of Egypt, and they're not minor powers. For decades, it was taken as axiomatic that Saudi Arabia and Iran were irreconcilable, and that's not true. But that's the level of distrust that some of the world's more powerful countries have to the regime. Now, China signed a 25-year comprehensive strategic partnership with Iran, $500 billion worth of investments, And, of course, since the sanctions on Russia and the Ukraine war, the two countries, Iran and Russia, have grown closer because they're both under sanctions, although it appears that Iran is more affected than Russia. But the trade between the two countries since then has gone up. As I've said about 1,000 times on this show, the sanctions really turned out to be a boon to the Russo-Chinese alliance. The other two, or the additional two, I should say, Ethiopia and Argentina. You know, Argentina is, for the most part, a European country. It's been made into a third world state. It wasn't, maybe say at the time when they clearly defeated the British in 1982. But if you read my lengthy article on Patreon on the subject, you'll see why we're told that they lost it. And Ethiopia is always struggling. It did have a non-Chalcedonian, you know, Orthodox or semi-Orthodox monarchy for many centuries, but it is strategic. And much of American foreign policy from here on in is going to be slowly but surely putting more pressure on these countries. That now you have two Latin American countries, two huge Latin American countries, formerly considered, you know, the backyard of the U.S. joining this, is, you know, to the regime is just a huge slap in the face. But you take them all together, and you have about a third of the world's gross domestic product. You have about almost half the world's population. So South Africa, and this is where the meeting took place, is kind of the odd man out, because it was a first world state that has entered into the fourth world only because apartheid was dismantled. And every single prediction that people like me made, and hundreds of others, came true, which is why it dropped out of really media coverage, starting roughly in the early, maybe the mid-1990s. Ethiopia has tremendous potential. I'm not certain South Africa does, at least with the current racial situation. Even worse than that, as far as the West is concerned, you have a small army of other countries that have publicly stated they want to join. And just a handful are, of course, Palestine, Morocco, Kuwait, Bahrain, and Algeria in the Islamic world. But this represents a realignment, undermining American power, and hence the power of liberalism and the dollar. American power is ideologically motivated and justified using liberal ideology, the nonsense about the rules-based order. But as far as policy concerning Israel is concerned, I dealt a few weeks ago with what Netanyahu's troubles and the extreme Zionist takeover of the government security services, what that means, where now you have mainstream criticism of the Israeli regime, which kind of buttresses the idea that parts of Ukraine at least were supposed to be colonized by settlers from Israel. The new Khazaria idea that I've spoken of for a very long time now. China is the big promoter of an increasingly large BRICS. China really wanted to see Saudi Arabia become a member for a whole bunch of reasons, but so did Russia and Brazil. The Gulf countries, now being part of the same organization as Iran, of course, they can enforce sanctions on Iran now. But this kind of diversification, you know, balancing these relations like the old third way, balancing, you know, between the two global powers, the Russo-Chinese alliance on the one hand and the rapidly declining U.S. and the regime on the other. I don't believe that the U.S. really has superpower status anymore. I've been saying that for a very long time. But another significant fact that has been put out recently is that China exports more to the developing world, that is to say, we call the third world, than to the European Union, the US, and Japan put together. The first, second, and third world initially came from Mao. First world being the US and its allies, essentially NATO, but you could include Japan, you know, Australia, what they used to call advanced economies. Second world was Russia and the Eastern Bloc, but that would also include, you know, Yugoslavia, sometimes India, Egypt. And the third world was pretty much everyone else. That's become, you know, I still use the terminology. I still think it works. There was also the fourth world, which would include places like Ghana and Niger and Ukraine today. But these have to do with to what extent, at least in purely financial and industrial terms, a country is wealthy. Reaching first world status, of course, is what developing countries want to do. They have to define that for themselves, as, for example, Iran has. But, you know, development of, you know, for better or for worse, a modern medical system, a modern educational system, even if it's done on purely Islamic principles, doesn't make any difference. A powerful scientific establishment, and an interest in technology. Again, Iran has made its own way in that respect. And countries like Syria, Egypt, Libya, Iraq, were on the verge of reaching first world status, which is why they were targeted. It isn't the military apparatus that worries the Israelis. It's the fact that they don't want first world economies on their borders. But the fact of these Islamic countries joining BRICS suggests that it almost as a civilization rather than just as individual countries, show the incredible popularity of multipolarity in the world. And the U.S., as several have said, can't do anything about it. But now that Iran's a member, sanctions are meaningless. They're as meaningless for Iran as they were, or as they are, to Russia. And middle power status, maybe Saudi Arabia and Iran are in that area, are the key. You know, these would be local hegemons, are the key to the realignment into civilizations and nations rather than the mindless ideology of liberalism. But there is a nervousness. Middle Eastern countries have, among other places, nervousness over the American banks, rather than, you know, saying the banks makes more sense than the U.S., the regime makes more sense saying to describe this, that these banks have over their development. Even J.P. Morgan, and they had this very simple statement. J.P. Morgan said, or the bank said, there's signs of de-dollarization emerging in the world economy. That sounds laconic, but for them to admit that at all is almost an admission of panic. Since at least 1971, but certainly before then, the dollar has been the symbol of American power over the financial system, but that simply isn't relevant anymore, since the United States is slowly heading to third world status itself. You have huge regions of the country now at third world levels, deliberately imposed by the regime. The point is to break out of dependency on American goodwill, or the goodwill of the regime. And it's become sharper in recent years because it's this power that's allowed the U.S. to arrogantly throw sanctions around, the weaponization of the dollar. And Even the IMF worried that the weaponization of the dollar will lead to the dollar's the slow abandonment of the dollar as a reserve currency. This is why the third world is very interested in BRICS. And the countries that have expressed interest often are countries that are in that middle level. They're not dirt poor, but they're clearly showing signs of some basic development. And I don't want to buy in to the Whig history idea of development towards, you know, industrialization and everything else. But I am talking about greater economic prosperity, defined in modern terms, for better or for worse, as the drive of probably every third world country in the world. How they do it is a different story, and that's why BRICS is very important. It allows them to do it on at different bases. Saudi Arabia has done it. Iran has done it on an Islamic basis. This isn't necessarily buying into the idea of modernist development all leading to the English system. Now, at the same time, these Arab newcomers have expressed interest in a BRICS currency, for the most part based on gold. And Saudi Arabia has been pretty clear about this. The U.S. simply can't stamp its authority in this region anymore, whether it be in the Middle East or North Africa or anywhere else. American weakness has been made just blatantly clear, not just in, you know, Central Asia, the sanctions failing, Syria, but in Ukraine, too, where you know, the U.S. is simply out of money and they're out of weapons. This is a humiliation, not just of the United States, but of liberalism and globalism as well. And, you know, these countries are joining BRICS to a great extent because they hate the concepts that are found in the Great Reset, which is far more intense and ideological than globalization in general, the so-called New World Order we used to talk about. People still have this habit of referring to the U.S. as a superpower. But when the United States clearly cannot govern its territory, it doesn't have full control over all of its territories. The major cities have fallen into the hands of non-white gangs. There's no question about that. And many of the urban areas have been reduced to third world status, of course, quite deliberately. So, but having a new currency makes a lot of sense. Because it is a break to dependency. So you say a country like Egypt wants to buy grain, for example, from Russia, but can't because of sanctions that the dollar allows the U.S. to put on the country. You know, they're worried about secondary and tertiary consequences. Abandoning the dollar, or at least lessening its influence, will allow them to do as they please. Another example I've heard, you know, Algeria. Algeria has been very interested in nuclear power, even nuclear weaponry, which is two very, very different things. And they would like to do it, and Russia and China are very interested in helping them with this, but they would rather not do it in dollars, because the use of dollars implies the potential interference from the regime. The war in Ukraine and the theft of, well, that's actually very murky, the theft of Russian assets as well as Venezuelan assets has proven that the U.S. is simply too erratic and chaotic as an actor for them to trust at any level, even if they wanted to. But the Ukraine war has given a huge burst of energy to countries in the developing world to join it. Especially the Africans and the Arabs have absolutely no interest in this, the anti-Russian obsession, an anti-Russian obsession that did not exist during the so-called Cold War. These are not parallel events. And we've spoken on this show, Saudi and various Gulf states are willing to confront the United States. They wouldn't have done this 30 years ago. We talked about how Saudi Arabia and the Russians cut oil production in 2022 in a bid to raise prices. Now, gas prices are gouging from companies. They know they can get away with it. There is no market in that. This is irrelevant to that, especially since the U.S. Could very easily be self-sufficient in oil And of course, nuclear power is a legitimate alternative. But this is extremely important as far as global politics are concerned. The liberal capitalist model of development is being rejected because you clearly see its results internationally. And this is a powerful and fairly new phenomenon. This is a crazy patchwork of countries that often wouldn't have a whole lot in common, except that they've had enough of how liberals operate internationally and domestically. And these aren't just, as Drago Bosnić said on August 29th, these aren't just nations. These are often states powerful enough in their regions to be civilizations in and of themselves. And you think, well, you know, what does Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa have in common? And, well, there is one thing. But I'm not sure what the one country that doesn't really offer much is South Africa. And putting a stamp of approval on that ridiculous system bothers me. Ethiopia, at least, is in an incredibly strategic position. The U.S. has been financing the enemies of that country for a very long time. So anyway, you have Argentina, Ethiopia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the UAE. In a few months, it will become full members. And again, I want to stress the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Peace that's been forged between China and India. The SCO saw peace being put together, at least temporarily, between India and Pakistan. That's the level of contempt that they have for liberalism, that they're willing to make peace with longstanding enemies for the sake of joining something that will break their dependence on the West, on the regime. Yemen, of course, as far as the Middle East is concerned, had a lot to do with this. U.S. financing of the aggression against that country, the hundreds of thousands of deaths, the hunger, the poverty. And so I don't care where you are, whether it be Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Ukraine, Libya, wherever the liberal empire is gone, destruction and poverty follow in its wake. Destruction and poverty end up creating a dependent, very tiny class of oligarchs, often educated in the U.S. or at least in Western Europe, running things. Gaddafi was a political and ideological threat because he was a national socialist in every possible definition of that term. And as always, he was extremely successful. Libya was also on the verge of first world status. Now, I've also spoken of Niger, who is absolutely fourth world. But apparently, they've had enough of Western influence and have brought Wagner in, which is absolutely, you know, frightening. There's some theories that the U.S. is behind it. They are not. All the nonsense about the U.S. supporting Pinochet is just that. I've spoken of that in relative to Indonesia. The CIA was very, very iffy about military governments. In 1976, sanctions were put on Chile, and he was banned from the country from the United States, at least when Carter was elected. But Ethiopia does offer, I mean, it's a Christian country for the most part, however eccentric, but they are in an excellent position if they can break out of their present extreme poverty. If they have any chance of that, it's going to be within this system. But in Africa, you have Senegal applying for membership. Again, I'm not sure what they're going to have to offer except a diplomatic weight. You know, you have all these African countries. You have two Latin American. And you can't deny then the power and significance of the Russo-Chinese alliance, which I have been talking about since before there was an internet. You know, the Congo, Guinea, Sudan, Tunisia. Zimbabwe, which is really no surprise, but again, what they have to offer, even collectively, is a separate question. But the military coups in West Africa, ideologically speaking, have been worth noting. as you know I have. And there are so many others. You know, Belarus, of course, has much to offer. Kazakhstan, Kuwait, Thailand, Venezuela, Vietnam have also applied, as have, you know, Pakistan, Syria, and Turkey. I think maybe these countries have far more in common than they seem to have, at least in the sense they have very strong a nationalist mentality and a total contempt for liberalism. That by itself, it's a very powerful thing to have in common. I really can't say that about South Africa, though. They stick out here like a sore thumb. And India, you know, develops in fits and starts. But since sanctions have rejected American bullying to not trade with Russia anymore, they've responded by doing just the opposite. So, you know, the U.S., especially since the Venezuela issue, has re-energized the Monroe Doctrine. Imperialism is now okay because it's being done in the name of liberalism and feminism and everything else that's promoted. It isn't just that, you know, this is, you know, the sea power, the Thessalocracy, or the power of the sea, the power of the trading state. It isn't just a matter of geopolitical sovereignty, but also cultural control. BRICS is exactly the opposite. It's not going to impose any kind of agenda except one that's homegrown. That's the opposite of colonialism. Colonialism isn't just direct control. It's also the indirect manipulation. Imposing neoliberal policies or just plain old liberal policies, this is far more damaging than direct colonialism, which certainly wasn't that bad for the countries involved. Neoliberalism, however, is that bad. And it's not even, you can't talk about the U.S. or France or what's left of Germany. You're talking about a minuscule and usually foreign and Jewish oligarchy that controls all of this. I've noted, for example, the article by Manilo Denucci, which came out on August 29th. This is the first sentence. He says, "The 15th BRICS summit held in Johannesburg, South Africa, made a series of decisions that lay the foundation for a new international order, an alternative to that imposed by the regime." This is, you know, I'm starting to see this more often. So you have 44 countries as of right now wanting to join this organization. The problem only is that it's going to become more diluted. But the benefit, you know, multipolarity isn't just you having regional power centers rather than global power centers. That's the formal way to define it. But it means that nationalism is now put to the front of the line. Because the whole point of this, same thing for the Silk Road, same thing for the SCO, same thing for the Russian Customs Union, is that nationalism, or at the very least, civilizational, regional development is what's promoted. That's what's behind multipolarity, that nations and regions are now empowered. The very opposite of the liberal system. The liberal system is imperial by its very definition. Capitalism has always been international. From the, you know, from the Renaissance on, from the Phoenician Empire on, it's always been international. But what's happening with current members, future members, and those who've applied? They also have in common a shared commitment to completely restructure a liberal, capitalist, and frankly, Judaic order. The economic, financial structures to one that devolves to nations and regions. Regions would be important in places like the Middle East, where countries there often have quite a bit in common, despite their friction. And now, of course, talk of a new development bank. Of course, you know, they said it in Venezuela, they said it in Libya, and we know what happened there. But now you're talking about half the world's population. and the steps for the bank and the new currency are going to take place, God willing, in Russia in the 16th meeting, which will be held next year. How the West, you know, the wounded animal is always going to lash out. The regime is disoriented. They overstate their power, and that leads to mistakes. Putting their reputation on the line in Ukraine. They did the same in Syria. How quickly people forget. This has been going on for a long time. They're making a lot of mistakes. And that's what happens when you're reacting to events rather than responding to them. So I'll close out with writing from my favorite economist, Paul Craig Roberts, who was talking about this. And he's really talking not so much about BRICS, but the dollar, which are very similar issues. And he's talking about the downward pressure on the dollar and the abandonment of it. And he says, the problem with the dollar has been brewing for a very long time. And I think in order to comprehend the kinds of problems the U.S. is very likely to face in the near future, we need to understand what is going wrong with the American economy and how the dollar has been set up for a serious loss in value. That is the pertinent problem. And he's talking, of course, about the central banks and their relation to dollar-denominated assets. And he says, all central banks held their reserves in dollars or at least in dollar-denominated assets, U.S. Treasury bonds, and today U.S. equities. So there's been a huge demand for dollar-denominated assets, financial assets, stocks and bonds, bills that are held as reserves by foreign central banks. That's how they settle their trade differences. What this means is that there's always financing for America's budget deficits and America's trade deficits because the dollars are reserves and countries use them to settle their trade differences. And of course, as a world economy grows slowly over time, the amounts become larger. So there's never been a problem with financing U.S. debt, neither the budget deficit nor the trade deficit. We're at an age here where debts denominated in trillions of dollars now become ordinary speech. It's become normalized. You know, 25 years ago, using words trillion it blew your mind. But, as Roberts has said pretty much his whole career, the U.S. has been driving itself into debt through offshoring its manufacturing base to Asia. And it was your neocon types who supported all of this, even subsidized it. But things are changing. And this BRICS meeting is one of the most powerful punches in the face to liberalism and the power of Jewish money that's occurred in a while. So the American sanctions on Russia and elsewhere, and the sanctions on my Patreon, I've written at great length on what a sanction is and where it comes from, the legal foundation and domestic politics. But I can't get into this now, but these tend to expand, and they can be applied anywhere at the will of the president. Holding reserves in dollars automatically means they're under the American's thumb. So if you don't comply with their foreign policies, as Roberts would say, their financial policies, they could confiscate reserves as Washington did to Russia and Venezuela. This is why countries are turning to alternatives. And he finishes up, but he doesn't finish up, but this is, you know, as far as we're concerned. Robert says, so we see now a movement away from the use of dollars as reserve currencies. We see countries now focusing on keeping their reserves in gold and in the currencies of their trading partners. And we see now that international balances between countries, that trade differences are being settled in other currencies, in their own, and currencies that are trading partners. The change is not really dramatic and not all at once, but it is ongoing. So the point of American foreign policy then, which is driven by economic interests, the principal goal, as I've said about a billion times, Paul Craig Roberts, many others have said it more recently, is to prevent the rise of any country that would be in a position to serve as a constraint on American unilateralism. And this is what I mean, at least in part, by saying that the wars of the 21st century from the U.S. are designed, I guess for the 90s too, in Iraq, are designed to prevent countries that are going to make the jump to first world status from actually doing it. Especially Iraq was a blatant example of that, Yugoslavia, and Libya. So these are, it's punitive fiscal, a punitive fiscal tool. Trade wars against China, whatever it is, but all that's done is facilitate the abandonment of the dollar, which means the weakening of American influence, which means the weakening of liberal influence over the world. And there is nothing better than that. This is all good news. Thank God. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.